Hello, I'm Chris Baisden, an editor with AICPA's Journal of Accountancy. You're listening to the J of A podcast, where we talk about the key issues facing the accounting profession. In today's podcast, we're going to talk about what CPAs and their clients need to know about government student loans. This has become a hot topic nationally, especially as the cost of higher education has increased over the past couple of decades. Before we get started, please take a few seconds to listen to a short message from our sponsor.
Did you know 75% of people now prefer to pay by credit or debit? With CPA Charge, you can let your clients pay their bill online and you'll get the reporting details you need for easy reconciliation. AICPA members can sign up at cpacharge.com/podcast and get your program fee waived for 6 months.
So my guests for today's podcast are from the nonprofit credit counseling agency, Consumer Debt Counselors. The first is Jim Sullivan, a CPA who is a board member at Consumer Debt Counselors. And we also have Melissa Towle McGuire, who's a student loan counselor for the organization. She's also the subject matter expert for the eFiscal software platform, Student Debt Solutions. So Jim, let's start with you. Today we're gonna focus on government student loans. Can you tell us a little bit about government student loans and how they differ from private student loans?
I can, Chris, and that's a good question to start with because that helps set the parameters for today's podcast, so that the listener understands that there is a distinct difference between government student loans and private student loans. Government student loans are dispersed by the Department of Education branch of the federal government. The borrowers apply for government student loans by filling out the FAFSA, which is the acronym for the Free Application for Financial Aid, each qualifying school year. The Department of Education reviews the applications and awards borrowers financial aid based on financial need as well as eligibility. Borrowers can apply for private student loans from a third party or a bank. The dollar amount given to the borrowers for private loans are mainly determined by the credit worthiness of the borrower. Most young borrowers who don't have their own credit history require a co-signer for approval for the private student loans. And as you can imagine, that's typically their parents who will co-sign the loans. Government loans have flexible repayment options. Several hardship programs are available and are easily modified if a borrower needs to extend repayment due to hardship. Private student loans do not have such beneficial programs, and any programs that may exist for modifying payments are really determined by on a case-by-case basis by the lender. Today, we're going to focus on repayment options of federal student loans, but we'll be, in our second podcast, we'll be talking in more detail about private student loans.
Thanks, Jim. So Melissa, in regards to government student loans, what's the basic payback period and interest rates of government student loans?
All right, perfect. So let's kind of start from the beginning. So a student who's applied for FAFSA, they're going to receive a certain amount of money that's going to cover 1 year of school. This money is going to be split between each semester. So for simplicity, let's say that a borrower received $5,000 for one semester for that school year. So that $5,000 is going to be divided into two separate student loans, a subsidized student loan and an unsubsidized student loan. A borrower who is more financially needy has a larger percentage of that $5,000 allocated as subsidized and a smaller portion as the unsubsidized. Most of the time, the subsidized student loans are going to be dispersed at lower interest rates, so they accrue less interest. And during times of postponement, like a deferment, or while the student is still in school, they do not accrue interest, while the unsubsidized loans are always accruing interest. So overall, subsidized student loans are the better of the two. So each year, the Department of Education adjusts the federal student loan interest rates. So for the school year of 2016 to 2017, the going interest rates for the subsidized and unsubsidized loan were both 3.76%. But for the 2017 to 2018 year, they are 4.45%. A borrower has the decision to make payments on their student loans while they are still in school. So on all unsubsidized student loans, interest begins to accrue the minute the loan is disbursed. Therefore, the earlier a borrower can begin repayment, the less they will end up paying overall. However, a typical borrower will wait until they graduate or withdraw from college to begin making payments. Your student loan servicer is going to put you into a six-month grace period after you are done with college. So during that grace period, a borrower does not have to make payments. Again, though, interest is still accruing on all the unsubsidized loans during this time. So after the grace period, all borrowers have a standard repayment plan that's set to 10 years. Therefore, each borrower's monthly payments determined by the interest rate, 120-month or a 10-year term, and the balance of that student loan. So real quick, I wanted to give an example. So a student who borrowed $40,000 at a 4.5% interest rate is going to have a student loan monthly payment of $414 a month for the next 10 years. So the total amount paid back, including interest, would be at that time $49,631. So a big thing we deal with is, how can I pay less interest overall? Changing your payment plan, not doing forbearance and things like that will extend, will increase the amount that you pay in the end.
Thanks, Melissa. So let's go with a hypothetical here. I graduated from college a long time ago, but let's say that I just graduated from college and I just got my first statement in the mail. My first payments are due and I don't know what to do. Can I just hide in my parents' basement and hope that the Department of Education never finds me?
No. Unfortunately, a student loan has no statute of limitations, and it's always going to be associated with your Social Security number, Chris, so it's never going to go away. If a borrower decides to ignore their obligations, the Department of Education does have the right to garnish any tax return you may ever receive, garnish your employer wages, and even beyond into retirement, if a borrower is to receive their Social Security income, they can garnish that too. So they're always going to be looking for you. Borrowers who want to hide in their parents' basement are not alone, though. Many borrowers are struggling. So currently, there are 44 million student loan borrowers, of which 15 million are delinquent, which means they are late on their payment, and 7 million are in default, which means that they've let that delinquency go beyond 270 days. This boils down to the fact that half of student loan borrowers in America are struggling. Most borrowers are not dealing with an $800 a month payment either. The average monthly payment is $350 per month, but yet most borrowers don't know where to begin to navigate all these repayment alternatives that the Department of Education has developed. And from what I see, it does create a level of frustration among borrowers and many of my clients, so that it ends up with most borrowers just ignoring the issue altogether. It becomes a cycle of financial trouble, and it begins to spin out of control. It creates a lot of issues for young borrowers, old borrowers, really anyone in between.
So can you elaborate, Melissa, a little bit on some of these alternative repayment programs that do exist that may help some struggling borrowers?
Yeah, so there's a lot. And so the Department of Education did create a payback system that gives any borrower in almost any situation options, right? So given that there are so many options, it really does get confusing, even for the most knowledgeable and educated borrower. It takes a certain skill level to really know which option is the best fit for a borrower's short, long-term goals, and then apply those to the options so that it successfully aligns with other financial needs, wants, and our concerns. So to kind of break this down for simplicity as a counselor, I divide all monthly student loan repayment options into two types. We've got a group called interest-based and a group that's known as income-driven repayment plans. So outside of that 10-year standard plan, there are other payment plans that are based on interest rates, repayment terms, and balances of that loan. And these are what I call the interest-based plans. These plans are known as the graduated, extended, and extended graduated repayment plans. A graduated plan allows a borrower to begin repaying their loan the first 2 years at a lower amount. And that lower amount essentially just covers the interest of that loan. So every 2 years, though, that payment amount increases or graduates by more than 17%. So by the last years of your repayment, your monthly loan payment is significantly higher by at least two or three times that standard amount. And if a borrower is looking to extend their repayment period, which in effect will then lower their monthly payment, and they also have over $30,000 in debt, then they can apply for that extended plan, and it gives them 25 years to pay off their debt. Extending a plan can also be done under a consolidation without meeting that $30,000 minimum amount. If a borrower consolidates their loans, the repayment term is either going to be 12 to 30 years, all depending on the amount of that consolidated loan balance. The consolidation is helpful for people who potentially might have used up all their forbearance time or hardship time where they don't have to make a payment. They need to qualify for public service loan forgiveness, want to simplify their repayment by having only one loan with one loan servicer, or defaulted on their student loans. So if a borrower has been paying on their loan for several years, a consolidation may be ineffective. There's also income-driven payments, which this has been a really hot topic this past decade. These plans allow a borrower that has a partial financial hardship to lower their monthly payment based on their household income. So the Department of Education has really complicated the matter of income-driven payment plans by really creating so many. There's approximately five different income-driven payment plans. They're income-based, income-contingent, income-sensitive, pay-as-you-earn, and revised pay-as-you-earn. Each of these plans do differ drastically, though, like in the amount of the discretionary income that's considered when qualifying the borrower as having that that financial hardship, the number of years a borrower has to renew the plan in order to get forgiveness. So if a borrower renews for about 20 to 25 years, depending on the plan, the remaining balance is forgiven or canceled. So, and the amount of interest that is also accruing and or being subsidized while a borrower is making the less than standard monthly payment. So all of those plans do differ in the points that I just mentioned. If a borrower consolidates too early or too late, enters into an income-driven plan, or exits out of an income-driven plan, each of these can have detrimental ends for the success of the repayment on that student loan. I cannot stress the fact enough that the education of the student loan borrower is so key in getting them on the right path to pay off of their student loan debt. And having that right knowledge in the very beginning of that payback period is really going to lead to the best overall results and paying back the loan in the most financial efficient manner. I'm going to say this probably more than once. Student loan payment options are not a one-size-fits-all scenario. So each borrower is unique based on the type of student loans, the time period, and then the trends for their repayment past, future, and future needs of their repayment. All of these factors do affect their eligibility and the fit for these alternative methods of repayment.
Yeah, and I just wanted to jump in because that's what I was going to ask was, is consolidation, right for everybody, or, are income plans right for everybody? You know, what seems like they're probably not, right?
No, not at all. It seems like there has been a trend to just say, do a forbearance or restart, do a consolidation. It's going to make you have a low payment, right? Or apply for this income plan. And I've seen so many times that maybe the income plan is going to work for 5 years for you, but life changes, your income's going to change. And then what essentially happens is you're going to have so much interest that is unpaid that you had a $30,000 loan, you left the income plan, and now you have a $50,000 loan. That's going to continue to accrue interest as well. So, your $30,000 debt just became, at the end of the repayment period, $100,000 you're paying off. And I'm really, truly not over-exaggerating that at all. So you really have to, look at individual circumstance to understand truly what is the best fit.
I see. And so I had interrupted you. What else do we need to know?
Yeah. So, to kind of just speak more about some forgiveness programs here and some common misconceptions that I do see today is that forbearance or income-driven plans are going to solve every borrower's problem. And there's a lot of misconception around some of the forgiveness aspects of the income plans, and also the different forgiveness programs that do exist that are usually, you know, based on occupation. So each income-driven plan does have a forgiveness period that is associated with it. So if a borrower continues to renew that plan every year and is eligible each year, then after 20 or 25 years, they may be privileged to the remainder of that debt balance being forgiven. However, there are tax implications associated with the forgiveness of the remaining student loan balance at the end of that, you know, 20 or 25 year period. There are also two common forgiveness plans that the Department of Education has created, the Teacher Loan Forgiveness Plan and the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Plan. The Teacher Loan Forgiveness Plan applies to any teacher or qualified staff member that works full-time at a Title I school. And just to clear up, a Title I school is a school that qualifies for additional funding because their school has a high number of children from low-income families. And after five consecutive years of full-time work, that qualifying staff member or teacher can apply for the forgiveness and either get $5,000 or $17,500 taken off their student loan balance. That all depends on the position in which they work. And then public service loan forgiveness is the newer of these two programs, and it does allow a full-time employee of a public service career. And usually these are local, state, federal agency, or nonprofit associations. And they can get the remaining balance of their student loan forgiven after 120 qualifying payments are made. So essentially it's 10 years. However, there are so many loopholes with these programs that they, like I said, there are so many misconceptions, and a lot of that is to do with these loopholes. And the loans have to be a specific type. The occupation has to qualify. The repayment plan has to be made under either a 10-year standard plan or under one of the income-driven plans. So navigating that public service eligibility can actually be extremely cumbersome. A borrower may need to consolidate to qualify, and if so, the borrower has to determine how to best stay on that income-driven plan throughout those 120 qualifying payments. I work with a lot of individuals who need help assessing, you know, how to best pay off their loan and if public service loan forgiveness is actually going to work out for them in the long run. It's not as simple as just submitting paperwork and qualifying. So a huge warning is that if a borrower was on a path to public service loan forgiveness or teacher loan forgiveness and changes their loans through a consolidation, this may also jeopardize their eligibility and time put into forgiveness programs. So again, it's so critical, and I cannot stress it enough, that all options really have to be assessed, analyzed, considered before understanding truly which option is the best fit for all, you know, individual borrowers.
Thanks, Melissa. So Jim, let's go back to you. You're a CPA. What's your advice for CPAs who are trying to help clients make sense of repaying government student loans?
Well, first, as a CPA, when I first started learning this area, and its complexity and all the options available, it reminded me a lot of 20 or 30 years ago when I first started learning how to work with the federal income tax code. It's complex, it's interrelated, and it's an area that a CPA is particularly good at. It's complex, but often we are called on to explain to clients what the impact is and what alternatives there are when they start planning to pay back the loan. But my advice to CPAs is, first of all, ask your clients if they or their children are responsible for student loans. Oftentimes, these are issues that a client might not bring up with you because they don't think you have the tools to solve their problem. So at your next meeting or call clients who you know have might have school-aged, meaning secondary school-aged kids are a little older than that, and ask if the outstanding student loans they may have is presenting a problem for them. So it's a great way, I think, to help establish or help strengthen your relationship with clients, and it also will give you an idea of the scope of the problem that's faced by your client base. It also, in the local community, is a once you have this skill set, getting out there and doing presentations, whether at local high schools or colleges, oftentimes there are plenty of seminars being held on getting into the right school and how to take out the loans, but you rarely see seminars held on once you have those loans are outstanding and once you graduate, how do you pay them back? What to expect? What alternatives are there if you have difficulties in paying them back? So it's a great topic, I think, for CPAs to get out into the local community and market their services and help potential clients understand exactly what's involved if they're taking out or their kids are taking out these government student loans. It also is a, I think, and Melissa has mentioned this to me, oftentimes recent graduates are struggling with their student loans, and this is also an opportunity not only to help them with their student loans, but also get involved in their other aspects of their financial planning to help them get started early doing financial planning early in their careers, and that's going to have payoffs as they get older. And I also think it's something that their parents will appreciate, that the opportunity for them to sit down and work through these issues with the student loans is also an opportunity to take a look at their full financial picture and help them understand the value of financial planning. So my advice is for CPAs to become familiar with the basics of these very complex programs, but that's something we're used to, and then learning how to communicate what alternatives there are to our clients and potential clients, and that's also something that we're used to, and I happen to think we are also very good at it. And then I also think it offers an opportunity to reach that next generation of potential clients, deal not only with student loans, but learn the overall value that a CPA can add, even though they're young, by providing advice on their finances. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here for CPAs to get involved. I think there's a lot of need for this these type of programs, and I think CPAs are particularly well suited for getting out and helping our clients solve these problems.
Thanks, Jim and Melissa. And I'd also like to thank our audience for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, check out more JFA podcasts on our website and on Podomatic.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.